Well, actually, that's not quite true. I said that it's beginning to take on some of the characteristics of failed states. And it is. I've gone through the reasons. I could repeat them. That's all the more reason for me to be concerned about it, the fact that I live here and it's my country. Sure, you're particularly interested in the places you care about and can't care about anything more than your own country.
Now, interestingly enough, in your recent book, Perilous Power, the Middle East and U.S. Foreign Policy, which you co-authored with Gilbert Achkar, you both support the idea that a major deterrent to democracy, especially in a place like the Middle East, is that the United States is actually opposed to it, which sort of contradicts the U.S. statements that come out of the government that say we are trying to promote democracy around the world.
Well, first of all, you should time those statements about promoting democracy carefully. When, of course, there's always talk about promoting democracy. That's, you know, everybody always talks about that. But it's boilerplate, didn't mean anything. When the invasion of Iraq was being planned and sort of sold to the country and to Congress, it was on the basis of what President Bush repeatedly called a single question. Will Saddam Hussein terminate his programs of developing weapons of mass destruction? That was the question. That was the basis on which Congress approved the use of force. That was actually even the official internal motivation. Weapons of mass destruction, Saddam's ties to terror. Well, a couple of months after the invasion, the single question was answered definitively the wrong way. We know the answer. After that, months after that, the president announced what he called his freedom agenda. This is November 2003, to great fanfare. The freedom agenda is the real goals were to bring democracy to Iraq, to the Middle East, to the world. Nobody can take this seriously, of course. And interestingly, in Iraq, they didn't take it seriously. Shortly after the president's November declarations, big headlines, a lot of excitement, a Gallup poll was released that had been taken in Baghdad. 1% of the population felt the United States invaded to bring democracy. 5% felt that the United States invaded to help Iraqis. Most of the rest concluded the obvious, which we all know, but we're not allowed to say.
Professor?
Furthermore,
A quick question, sir, based on what you just said there, I want to get to you. It's an email that came in from Mauritania. I just pick up on what you were talking about there. Safia Amar asks, don't you think that the U.S. policy in Iraq and Afghanistan is only triggering more hatred in the Arab and Islamic world? What would you suggest to limit those effects?
It's not just I think. It is definite. Steady studies are coming out. Another one just came out a few days ago from major polling institutions, which are showing exactly what the questioner points out. Yes, fear and hatred of the United States is growing. In fact, not just in the Islamic world, even in Europe, which is the region most sympathetic to the United States. The effect of George Bush's policies, particularly the invasion of Iraq, has been to raise the United States to the most feared country in the world. What should be done to alleviate this? To first of all, to terminate the actions that are causing it, and then to deal with the real issues. Like, it would be a great thing if the United States were to support democracy, but it doesn't. And we know that. It didn't do it before 9/11, it doesn't do it now. If you want maybe the most dramatic example is Palestine. There were elections in Palestine in January 2006. Free elections, carefully monitored, everybody agreed they were free. The population voted the wrong way, not the way the U.S. wanted. How did the U.S. react?
Right.
The U.S., with Europe trailing behind, immediately moved to punish the population severely for voting the wrong way.
Well, sir,
how can you look at that and say they're trying to promote democracy?
We got a call in just now from Anwar in London. He's on the line, if he might ask his question of you. Anwar, go ahead.
Oh, hi, assalamu alaikum. Good evening. I just like to ask, you know, why is it that Democrats now they have passed a bill and Bush is, and his hawks and his, you know, colleagues are stuck to the same old policy that war must continue, the killing must continue. I think it is time. The enough British, American and the civilians, which are in thousands of Iraqis, have been killed. I think the American people should come out and speak, and we must bring it to an end now, I think.
Okay, let's get Professor Chomsky to answer this. Perhaps I can ask it in this way, sir. What is it that stops the American people having some kind of voice in this? If Anwar is correct that people are against the killing that's going on, why is it that the views of people are not being translated into action in terms of policies?
Well, now we're back to the matter of failed states, not just on this issue, but on a whole range of crucial issues. Public opinion is pretty strongly opposed to government policy. In fact, on many issues, important ones, both political parties are well to the right of the general population. That's true on domestic issues, too. It's been pretty well documented. I've written a lot about it, so have others. That's a failure of the functioning of the American democratic system. I mean, it's a very free country, freest country in the world, has formal democratic institutions, but for a variety of reasons, they are not functioning in ways which make them responsive to the public. And the public knows it. That's one of the reasons there's so much disillusionment with the political system. Now, why doesn't the public do something about it? Well, you know, that's a function of atomization of people, of difficult economic circumstances, not difficult by world standards, but difficult by the standards that they rightly expect and see, a lack of breakdown of the major organizations. The unions, for example, used to be a major force for democratization, but they've been harshly repressed. They by now barely exist. Illegal labor practices are used to destroy them and so on. And the result is a society which is opposed to policy on major issues like this one, but right, hasn't found the organizational forms, hasn't developed the organizational forms to press for a real voice in foreign policy, or domestic policy for that matter.
Right. Professor, you know, you'd mentioned the Israeli-Palestinian situation a moment ago before Anwar's question, and I want to get an email to you that came from Andrew Leidner in the United States, who says, "You are Jewish. If Israel is destroyed, what part will you have played in it, and will you give yourself a pat on the back when it is?"
Well, I've felt for many years, and have written, incidentally, that the people who call themselves supporters of Israel are in reality supporters of Israel's moral degeneration and probably ultimate destruction. I mean, Israel can have security. In fact, that's been true for over 30 years. It has chosen instead expansion at the cost of security. I can go through the reasons if you want to know the details.
Probably we're short on time and a couple of callers waiting, so
yeah.
Better to...
Okay, yeah. But that means that, you know, I agree with my Israeli friends who think that the policies they're taking are extremely first of all, wrong, but also self-destructive, and that if they do pursue security and peace instead of expansion and oppression, their prospects are very much improved.
Naveed's on the line from London. Naveed, what would you like to ask Professor Chomsky?
Hi, Mr. Chomsky. I'm a great fan of yours. I have two questions to ask you. The first one is basically the UK government and the US government have this term war on terror. A lot of people have equated the term war on terror to a war on Islam, but this has been denied by George Bush, Mr. Blair. If there was to be a war on Islam, what would it be like, and what would one be? So if someone was to implement a war on Islam,
right,
what would that be, and the difference between that and this? And my second question really is, I mean, I've read a lot of your articles. As I said, I'm a big fan. You know, I would like to, as a Muslim, invite you to Islam. And just to say, feel free to read as many books as possible.
Naveed, we've got less than a minute now for Professor Chomsky to ask. Apart from the offer to convert to Islam, Professor, you have the question about what would a war against Islam be like if it was to take place. Very briefly, sir.
War on Islam would be, you know, Third World War might bring the species to an end. But the United States is not engaged in a war against Islam. George Bush is correct. It's, for example, that the oldest and most valued ally of the United States in the region is Saudi Arabia, because that's where most of the oil is. It happens to be an extreme Islamic fundamentalist state. In the 1980s, during the first so-called war on terror, the United States, the government, was fighting a war largely, to a large extent, against the Catholic Church, which was sponsoring liberation theology.
That was Professor Noam Chomsky in an interview I did earlier in place of the interview we had planned with former U.S. military interrogator Tony Lagaranis. He was unable to make it at the last minute, but we'll try to reschedule that one for you. On the next show, a Syrian American who's devoted two decades to promoting dialogue between Syria and Israel. A look at his behind-the-scenes dialogue on that show. And don't forget, you can send us your questions and comments in advance. Send emails to riz at aljazeera.net.